people don't really understand that a medlar is a palm. And in an upcoming episode, Rhea and I will be talking about medlars and just how
beautiful they are.
Yes, just how beautiful we are. This week, we have
Rebecca de Kramer.
Rebecca de Kramer of Scott Laboratory. And you are listening to Cider Chat.
That was perfect.
Thank you, Rhea.
Episode 119. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
And also talking palms.
That's right. Also talking palms, like the medlars and Mr. Quince.
Yes, I'm here too. Thank you very much.
And of course, Perry Pear.
Rhea, I noticed that this week's episode is on off odors on cider. And I just want to make note that normally there is no off odor in Perry.
Well, that might be true, Perry Pear, spoken as a Perry Pear, but you know, there can be off odors in Perry too.
Then why don't they have a workshop on that?
Yeah, I could see your point, Perry Pear, but maybe they just haven't, you know, gotten that slot in there yet. It is very, very technical, as you well know about Perry.
Well, indeed I do.
Yes, indeed you do. And for all the new listeners out there in Ciderville, these are the Talking Palms, the Medlars, Mr. Quince, and Perry Pear, who help me get this podcast out every week to you. And they certainly keep the Cider House pretty busy and a lot of fun, too. And we are going to be talking about off odors in cider, and that is a presentation done by Rebecca de Kramer. I recorded it at CiderCon 2018, so that'll be coming right up. But in the meanwhile, get a glass of cider, sit back, or put it on cruise control wherever you are, because we're going to catch up with a little bit of news around and about Ciderville, and then we'll be rolling into the main chat. So hang on, because we'll be right back in just a moment.
Perry Pear, while Rhea's out getting some cider, why don't you read that piece that came in from Ross on Y?
Absolutely. I've been waiting to do this all day. Two wonderful things happen on March 8th. Well, maybe actually three. First off, it was a celebration of women around the world called International Women's Day. And it was a kind of ordinary day here at the Cider House until a notification came in to Rhea that the cidery called Ross on Y, based in Herefordshire in the UK, joined the Cider Chat Patreon page via the Cider Going Up campaign. And they wrote on Instagram and all their other social media outlets the following: to celebrate International Women's Day, we have decided to become a patron of the wonderful Cider Chat podcast created by the stellar, and we all agree that here in the Cider House, Cider Chat MC Rhea. I was lucky enough to stumble across the podcast recently and have been blown away by how good Rhea's podcast is. There's even an episode with Oliver's Cider and Perry LTD! Exclamation point. Today, we are paying tribute and thanks to all the women in Ciderville. As Rhea would say, we raise a glass of cider to you.
That is so marvelous. She was crying all day long.
I know.
It was a good thing we had plenty of tissues on hand.
A lot of people don't know that she's pretty sensitive to this and worked really hard to keep this podcast online.
Indeed, she does. And so, the third thing that happened on March 8th is that the current patron, John Edwards, just signed up too via the Cider Going Up campaign page.
And you could join too. Just go to the Patreon page and help keep this podcast on.
Hey, Palms. Wow. Boy, I'll tell you, hanging out with the wild yeast in that oak barrel in the back room, I almost didn't come back to record the rest of this podcast. But I'm ready to go and talk about the Ross on Y contribution to the Cider Going Up campaign, that they are now regular supporters of Cider Chat via the Patreon. And also John Edwards, he became part of the Cider Going Up campaign too. It all happened last week. I'd like to talk about that.
Excuse me, Rhea, but Perry Pear took the time and opportunity to do that for you.
Really? Well, I'm a little speechless.
We know how much it affected you, Rhea, so we took it into our own palm hands and did that for you.
Wow, you guys. I don't know what I'd do without you. You really make doing this podcast so special. Well, thank you. I know you mentioned Ross on Y, UK Cidery, just freaking fantastic. You've heard me talk about it ever since I had the first sip of one of their ciders back, I don't know, a couple of years now. Blew me out of the water. Boy, I was kind of, I lost it last week when they did that. They did that contribution.
I know the feeling when I speak about Perry Pear. I often get a tear in my eye.
Oh, these pears. I think this is a little bit different, Perry Pear.
Regardless, we know what you mean, Rhea.
Yeah, okay. And John Edwards, you cover that too. There will be a chat coming up on his chemical analysis, the chemical fingerprints, an analysis of cider coming up. But all right, that's fine. We're going to then go straight into this week's episode with Rebecca DeCremer. What do you say?
It's all queued up, Rhea, and ready to roll.
Well, alrighty then. Well, let's just take a little bit of a moment here, and then we'll come right back with our main chat. You're going to hear first from Paul Vanderhyde. He is now the president of the United States Association of Cider Makers, and he introduced Rebecca DeCremer for this particular episode. Now, I want you to know that there is a PDF that you can follow along, and all you need to do is go to the Cider Chat website, go to episode 119. If you subscribe to the eCider News, you'll get a download link to that PDF that you can follow along with as Rebecca's talking. Certainly listening to this chat alone is fine. Having the PDF really makes a difference. And, you know, you get this kind of freebie. Now you get signed up to the eCider News and get all the kind of early news snippets before it goes online. So without further ado, how about if we all, I'll go back to the barrel room, grab another glass, and we will join this chat with none other than Rebecca DeCremer of Scott Laboratory, speaking on correction and prevention of sulfur off odors presented at CiderCon 2018, or what I like to call stinky cider troubleshooting.
I'm here to introduce Rebecca DeCremer. I'm going to cheat a little bit here because even talking about Rebecca is too smart for me to remember. Rebecca joined the fermentation group at Scott Labs in 2005. She's currently the Velcorin product manager and cider specialist, a member of the technical sales department specializing in fermentation, cellar, filtration products. She's also the technical editor of Scott Laboratory's Cider Handbook. She graduated from UC Davis in 2002 with a BS in biological sciences. And I've known Rebecca since the first CiderCon, in-person CiderCon in 2012 in Chicago. And except for 1 year due to a previous pregnancy, yeah. Ironically, she has been a staple here at CiderCon. She's super smart and is on speed dial for our cidery. So make sure that you take advantage of the Cider Handbook and just soak it in. I think you're going to really appreciate it, and because I know we do. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you everybody for coming this afternoon. It gives me the warm and fuzziest to see a full room. It's always nice to see. So as Paul mentioned, I'm the center specialist at Scott Laboratories. I've been the center specialist since 2012. Scott Laboratories is there, always on speed dial. If you have questions, we have not only myself, but also a whole breadth of technical staff, and we're more than happy to answer questions. So today, what I'm going to talk about is one of the most common calls that I get from customers is stinky ciders. You might make ciders for years, never have any problems, and then you just have a real stinker rear its ugly head, or you have kind of persistent issues. So what I'm going to talk about are all kind of tools and suggestions. By no means are you expected to do everything that I'm discussing, and in fact, if you're not having reoccurrent issues, I would say you might not have to change anything. But it is something that it's nice to know that there's things that you can do to mitigate issues from occurring, but also ways to kind of correct if something does kind of rear its head again. So what I'm going to talk about is first kind of what are sulfur off-putters. Most people refer to it as H2S or hydrogen sulfide, but there's a whole bunch of different components that can actually be making your cider stinky that are sulfur-based compounds. We're going to talk about what causes that creation of those compounds. And then what we're mainly going to focus on is prevention, because prevention is always going to be a better thing than correction. Correction, you're going to strip more character, things like that. But there are tools in case things do pop up. So I'm going to get a little bit into some of the science in just a second. But some of the descriptors when we talk about sulfur off compounds is, you know, people know H2S, but most commonly they associate it with a rotten egg smell. And that is pretty easy for most people to identify. I personally have a pretty low threshold for it. Some people don't, but people will also call it reduced. You can also have different kinds of sulfur compounds where you can get like a burnt rubber character, an onion, skunky, garlic, funk. If you are having off odors, it does not necessarily mean it is a sulfur off odor, so try and be as descriptive as you can when you're talking to anybody, any vendors, things like that, because they might steer you in the wrong direction if you're giving wrong descriptors, and have other people smell it and see if they can give you guidance too. Because what tends to happen is you get a house palate and you get very accustomed to what your ciders smell like. And so you might not be as obvious when you have a fault kind of creeping in. So there's the main kind of sulfur culprits out there. Hydrogen sulfide is kind of the first form that generally pops up. It's the most simplistic, and thankfully it's the easiest to get rid of if it does occur. There are other things that can also be produced, or captains. They're generally derived from breakdown of certain amino acids. They can also be removed, but then you can also have some oxidation of those where you can get dimethyl disulfide and things like that, dimethyl mercaptans, and those are aromatic, but you can't easily remove them with things like copper. So there's different things. Some remediation people will do just kind of right out the gate is if they're having sulfur off odors, they'll try and aerate, splash, which oftentimes if it's just H2S is great. It can actually blow it off. You've taken care of the issue. If it's gone to any of these other forms, you can actually get into a component of oxidation, and then you can get it in a more difficult form to remove. So we're going to talk about some of these different ways to remediate and things like that, but just know when we talk about sulfur, it's not just H2S, there's a whole bunch of different compounds. If you've done any tests and you've done like a penny test or like a copper treatment and you're not touching the aroma, that means it's gone into more of the dimethyl mercaptan and things like that. And those you have to do aggressive remediation to kind of get rid of. Now, the most abundant source of sulfur off odors, H2S, is due to yeast stress. In terms of, people always ask me, so I sell fermentation products. I sell an entire portfolio of fermentation products. And people ask me, what products would you suggest? And generally, as a startup cidery, the thing you should focus on the most is making your yeast happy. Because if you have happy yeast and you have a good juice or a good base, you will have a good product. If you have unhappy yeast, they will make your life hell. So you need them, right? That's what makes alcohol. But you want to keep them happy. That's really the most important thing. I mean, we sell a bunch of other additives that I'm more than happy to sell you, but the first thing I'm going to tell you is make your yeast happy, because they're going to be the biggest culprit in producing really any of the off compounds that you can get in cider. So both H2S, volatile acidity, things like that. There is also some chemical reduction of elemental sulfur. So sulfur is used in orchards for apples for control. depending on when that spray comes, that could be, especially if you're getting sulfur compounds right out the gate in your fermentation, that could be residual copper that's left on your apples. So just something to take in consideration in terms of what orcharding practices are being used and things like that. And then there's other sort of metabolisms and things like that. But generally, the main problem is yeast. So in terms of, I kind of already touched upon these, but there is an evolution of sulfur off odors. Again, the most simplistic form is hydrogen sulfide. And that you can get from NML sulfur on fruit. The yeast can produce it. Just kind of, it can fluctuate depending on the oxidation status of the, you know, you can aerate, blow it off. Then you can have the mercaptans, which again are kind of reduction of different, more complex molecules, so they're a little bit harder to get out. And the disulfides and the dimethyl sulfides are the oxidation of methyl mercaptans. And so sometimes if you've gone to mercaptan and you try and aerate, you just push it into a disulfide form, which is much harder to get out. So aeration is a tool for sure in reducing sulfur compounds, but something to be kind of cautious with. If you're already halfway through fermentation, I wouldn't recommend aeration because the yeast is not going to use the oxygen and it can possibly oxidize it. Do you have a question?
Yeah, what would you do like at the end of fermentation when like a mercaptan would happen?
When you're seeing it towards the tail end of your fermentation, but it's still fermenting, it's not finished.
Yeah, like the last 10 points.
So there are some things that you can do. Generally, we don't recommend nutrients that far in the game just because the yeast is not going to assimilate them. There are some yeast derivative products that you can use that have good bioabsorptive properties, which is an option. Really stirring and keeping the yeast in suspension is tremendous because you can get stratification within your tanks. And the yeast, especially as alcohol starts to build, the density changes, right? So you have more and more yeast that's settling to the bottom, and it can't reach its sugar sources. So it kind of signals to stressors, to other yeast saying, hey, I can't get this. And so that constant stirring, I mean, you don't really want to aerate at that point. You want to make sure you're kicking up the lees, though, because that can really, really help. So sometimes it's as simple as that. Other times you need more remediation. You need to look at nutrition strategies. You need to look at your yeast strain that you're using. You need to look at your juice source, what they're doing. The difference can also be as simple as what is your juice source. It could be fresh juice versus frozen juice versus concentrate, and all those different scenarios can, even just stored fruit, even if it's fresh pressed, I'll see that fresh harvested fruit has differences than stuff that's stored fruit that's been stored for a period of time. So unfortunately, you're never gonna have, you know, if you're fermenting year round, even if it's the same juice, it's not the same juice year-round because it's been stored and things like that. So those are things to take in consideration with nutrition strategies, but stirring does a lot. So in terms of control points, so how do we get a control of this? Now, like I said, if this pops up every once in a while, it could just be some sort of variation in that particular batch. Maybe you got too hot, something like that. You might not have to change anything. It just know, okay, let's not do that again, and then continue on with your traditional fermentation practices. If it's a recurring issue, that's when it's good to kind of start looking at the different processes that you actually follow and which things you can comfortably change with still maintaining, obviously, the brand that you are selling. You know, not changing everything at once because that's going to change your product, but looking at things that you can easily change and trying to troubleshoot that way. Unfortunately, oftentimes it's not the first thing you try, you know, so it might be, you might have to do some trial and error to kind of figure out what that one point is. But in terms of where these issues are coming from, like I said, in terms of your juice source, that can be very dependent on the kind of sulfur compounds or the issues that you have with fermentation. Like I said, fresh juice is going to have different scenarios in that can cause problems than stored juice or frozen juice or stored apples versus fresh apples, concentrate versus anything else. So looking at your juice source, the more concentrated it is or the more clarified your juice, that can lead to more issues because you have a more depleted nutrient media and it's also just not a lot to keep yeast in suspension. Vice versa, if it has too much solids, meaning it's a fresh press, that can also lead to issues. So we'll talk about that. So looking at your juice source, and then looking at fermentation factors. And then finally, kind of storage conditions. Are you keeping it on your lees? If you start having a stinky ferment, don't age on your lees. Rack as soon as you're finished with your fermentation, because yeast can, even after it dies, can continue to produce sulfur compounds. It has sulfur reductase enzymes in it that will just continue processing and continue making stink. And sometimes people will be like, oh my God, it's terrible. I'm like, well, rack. And they're like, oh, that did it. That took care of it, because all of the stink was trapped in the yeast. So racking is very important.
I am sure, Sartorville, that you are realizing that this is a pretty technical yet super informative presentation by Rebecca DeKramer. So I want to remind you that you could go to ciderchat.com, go to the show notes for episode 119. There is a link where all you need to do is click that. It will ask you to subscribe to eCider News, and then you will be given the download form for the PowerPoint that was presented during this presentation. It's simple to do, and the return will be great because you'll be able to follow her actual presentation notes, and there's a lot there. On the PowerPoint, you could go to slide number 6 and continue along with this presentation with Rebecca DeKramer of Scott Laboratories.
Making changes to your juice process can have a pretty large impact on your final product. So it's kind of one of those things that I have people look at as one of the latter steps, because changing your clarification regimen on your juice can change a lot of the other enzyme development of your yeast. Some of the yeast needs certain solids to produce the kind of fruity floral aromatics that we like. And if you reduce those solids too much, you can have a different product when you finish your fermentation. But look at your turbidity. In the wine industry in particular, they very much have different dialed in practices for different kind of wine varietals. Typically for like fermentation of Sauvignon Blanc, something like that, they clarify the bejesus out of that juice before they ferment, because they want certain aromatic compounds to evolve. If you have too clarified of a juice, you can stress the yeast, because again, there's nothing holding the yeast in suspension. So it just settles to the bottom and you get that stratification very early on. So it's trying to keep it kicked up, feed it, because you've depleted the nutrients a lot, and keep it into solution. That being said, you can also, again, have problems if your juice is too turbid. Certain apple varietals, and I don't know which ones those are, but there are certain apple varietals that can have more, be more prone to sulfur off compounds. And if you're seeing just certain varietals are more prone, you might look at, okay, well, how much solids do I have in this juice? Is it a really turbid juice? Is this a fresh pressed juice that has lots of solids in it? Maybe I should look at some light clarification of my juice before I inoculate, rack off those solids, and you might actually get a reduction in your sulfur compounds just from doing that, because there's not as much of those solids for the yeast to attack. So fresh juice, you know, you have certain, do you treat bulk juice? Like I said, we see very significant differences in stored fruit versus fresh fruit, and people are constantly like, I can't understand it. It's the same, it was picked the same time, it was all harvested at the same time. Why is this so problematic? But again, over time in storage, the chemistries of an apple change. And we know that just from consuming apples. So it shouldn't be a surprise that that can also impact how our fermentation behaves. And then concentrate, if you are using concentrate, concentrate has been depectinized before it was concentrated, because otherwise it would turn into jelly. And so it's very, very clear. So sometimes you have to add solids back to it to keep the yeast in suspension, or stir and add lots of nutrients. So just depending on your fruit source, things to take in consideration. You're always welcome to call and explain your scenario, and we can kind of give suggestions based on that. Now, fermentation. Fermentation is the most important component of prevention of sulfur off odors. Okay, because again, happy yeast is not going to produce off odors. Unhappy yeast is going to let you know, and it's very good at it. It just, that's its signaling device. It tells everybody around it, its other yeast strains, hey, this isn't a very favorable growing condition, and so then they all start producing it, because they just know, hey, we should probably slow down. So happy yeast is very important. If you are doing indigenous fermentations, meaning you're using uninoculated ferments, you can totally do that. I sell yeast, so I suggest not. But you can totally do that. just know you have no control over the strain that is doing your fermentation. So, you know, you're not going to be able to kind of know, oh, hey, this one has a high nutrient demand, so I should probably kick up my nutrients, because you don't know what's actually doing your fermentation. So that just, it's a little bit more kind of leap of faith with indigenous fermentations. I would still strongly suggest robust nutrition strategies, even if you're not inoculating, because that's going to be really the only control you have over that fermentation. Now, in terms of commercial pitch, that is, you can get liquid yeast, you can get dry yeast, you can use wine yeast, you can use beer yeast, you can use cider yeast. Follow the manufacturer's recommendations, okay? Don't use a yeast outside of its parameters. If you decide you're like, hey, this yeast sounds interesting, and it has a temperature range of 78 to 95 degrees, one, it's probably a red wine yeast strain, that's fine, you can use it, but don't try and ferment it at 55 degrees, okay? There's a reason why it has those temperature parameters, because that's the temperature parameters that it thrives in. What I've seen with people that are using brewing yeast, they really try and push the envelope and do cold fermentations, and that's not how beer is fermented. And so that's not how the yeast likes it the best. So just take those things into consideration when picking commercial strains. It is important to obviously pick strains that tickle your fancy and provide the sensory impact that you want. But if you have no temperature control, don't use a strain that says must have temperature control, because we have certain strains in our portfolio that it says that for a reason, because if you don't have temperature control, it will ferment so fast, foam, geyser everywhere, and not necessarily get stinky, but make a really big mess. So please follow manufacturer's guidelines for those strains parameters. All of the manufacturers should have basic things like nutrient demand, temperature specs listed on their spec sheets. We have it all listed in our handbook, so read that, it's there for a reason. Do not under-inoculate. There's a lot of people that kind of have this perception that, hey, these inoculation rates of like 2 pounds per 1,000 gallons are based on wine fermentations. And yes, they are. And so you're like, well, I'm only fermenting to 7% alcohol, and they ferment to 14% alcohol of wine, so I'm going to cut my addition in half. Don't do that. There's a reason why we have these inoculation rates, is because yeast has to get to a certain biomass in order to ferment. And so if it is at a low inoculation rate, that means it has to divide more times to get to that biomass to ferment. So if it's divided, and every time it divides, it just shares its pool of nutrients. So if you have multiple generations that are initiating your fermentation, those cells are more stressed because they have less of kind of the beneficial fatty nutrients in their membrane. And so they just can't handle the sugar and then the alcohol as well as something that was inoculated at 2 pounds per 1,000 gallons. So follow the yeast pitch recommendations. It's not because we want to sell more yeast. It is because we want to get you to that appropriate biomass in a timely manner. Some people also think, oh, well, if I underpitch, it'll be easier to stop my fermentation. No, because again, you're not going to a super high alcohol, so the yeast is gonna finish. And again, you have to get to a certain biomass for it to ferment, so you're still trying to suppress the same amount of population. You just have potentially a higher stressed population, which is more likely to produce sulfur off odors, things like that. So follow manufacturer's recommendations for each yeast pitch, and then rehydrate accordingly. If you're using a liquid yeast, add that appropriately. If you're using a dry yeast, don't just throw it in. I know it's tempting, and that's what a lot of home stores tell you to do, because when you're doing 5 gallons, those ferment much easier than doing 500 gallons, okay? There's a reason why we have rehydration protocols. So the yeast, when it's dried, has little fissures and stuff like that that can envelop it. And it will ferment if you just throw it into the cider. It will. But when it plumps, it's plumping in a sugar solution as opposed to a water solution. So one, it doesn't plump the same way because there's a different osmotic pressure gradient on it. So it just doesn't start out as happy and as healthy. And so you just are kind of perpetuating kind of a stress from the very beginning. So if you're using dried yeast, please follow manufacturer's guidelines.
Before we hear from Rebecca speaking about yeast selections, I'd like to share with you the upcoming trip to Normandy via the Totally Cider Tours. It will be taking place on September 23rd through September 29th. We meet at the Charles de Gaulle Airport right outside of Paris, and you will be returned to the airport on the 29th, making this a very stress-free cider-centric tour. Come along with me as we go to the Pays d'Auge region of Normandy and then swing south into Domfront, where Peripair reigns. I am currently accepting reservations. Send an email to me, ria@ciderchat.com, for more details. Now back to Rebecca de Kramer and selection of cider yeast.
Yeast selection. So if you've already established your brand and you have something that you like in terms of sensory with your yeast, I'm not telling you to change your yeast. But if you are having persistent issues with sulfur off compounds and you've tried looking at your juice practices, you've looked at your nutrient regimen and still nothing's working, you might have to look at changing your yeast. There are certain yeast out there that are just stinky yeast. They just are. And we know it. We can actually identify which ones they are. But, you know, maybe you don't use that strain anymore. And you know it's hard because you don't want to change your flavor profile. So what you can do is you can always call, you can talk to your vendors and see what options they have. You can either look for low nutrient requirement yeast, which are going to be easier to use, especially if you don't have the ability to really manage your nutrition. There's also a bunch of new strains on the market that are low H2S to no H2S producing strains. We have some in our portfolio. Gusmer has a pretty robust portfolio. Not sure who else has them, but those are options as well. Now, obviously, if you change your yeast strain, you're changing your product. So just keep that in mind. But as a last-ditch effort, it's not a bad idea to look at if you're having persistent issues. Now, I don't hear about this as much as when I did when I first started with the cider industry. It's something we don't really see in wine at all. But in the beer industry, it's very common to repitch or like mother tank your beer yeast, right? You just do tank to tank to tank and propagate. And that works for beer, but beer has a much higher pH than cider and it has a lot more nutrition. Whereas cider is low pH and really pretty barren. Cider has less nutrition than even grapes. So propagation, I do not recommend. If you do decide to propagate your yeast, please, if you have a stinky ferment, don't reuse that yeast. Okay? Seems kind of obvious, but start fresh because once something starts getting stinky, it doesn't generally revert back. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so those are just kind of suggestions with just yeast selection in general. Now we need to talk about nutrition, because the next step is really the most important step for making your yeast happy is to make sure it's well fed. Now, as I mentioned, cider is very low nitrogen. When we talk about winemaking, kind of a standard YAN, yeast assimilable nitrogen, it's the nitrogen that yeast can consume, that we like to try and achieve is like 200 to 250 grams per liter. And in terms of, this is just a thing that I found online. We actually have a much better analysis now. I know Amanda Stewart from Virginia Tech has done a ton of research on nitrogen content of apple. But you can see we have substantially less nitrogen available for us in apple. Now, you aren't trying to achieve the same alcohol content with your ciders as you are with a wine. That being said, you still need a good pool and baseline of nutrition for the yeast to start out and be happy. So, look at your nutrition. That's usually the first thing that we identify because most people, again, don't want to change their yeast. They don't want to change their juice clarification practice. But we can really shore up nutritional strategies. We have some different guidelines in our handbook based on nitrogen that you can look at for kind of strategies that we suggest with the different yeast nutrients that we recommend. Sometimes, again, it's trial by error, unfortunately, because it could just be your apple source in particular is more prone to sulfur compounds. So you have to shore up a little bit more in your organic, you have to add something that contains thiamine, and it's just worth kind of looking at and playing with. So again, look at your juice source, Again, if you're using concentrate, please use nutrition, because there's nothing in there to feed the yeast. It's all been clarified out. And then look, none of my cider producers measure their yam. And frankly, a lot of wineries don't measure their yam either. We don't recommend ingredient-based or recipe-based nutritional strategies, right? Because you're not actually targeting that particular fermentation. That being said, most people aren't measuring. So I'm gonna tell you to measure your yam, and then I'm just gonna know in my heart that you're not going to. So we'll just keep that as an unwritten, like unsaid thing. It's not a bad idea, especially if you are having persistent issues. Send it into a lab and just have them give you some numbers. It's not gonna be the same all the time, because again, juice evolves, things like that. But at least you can get kind of a ballpark of what you're looking at and try and develop a strategy based on that. Again, it's not always gonna be right, but it'll be closer than just kind of blind.
Did you say the nitrogen target levels were by yeast or in the...
So...
Like if it says high nutrient need or low nutrient need, does that convert to a nitrogen level we should be targeting?
Nitrogen, we're learning a lot about nutrition. For years, the wine industry based their nutrient procedures based on yeast assimilable nitrogen and hitting these target YAM numbers. And those were based on research done with diammonium phosphate, which is just inorganic nitrogen, which is just the simplest source of nitrogen you can feed to your yeast. We have been seeing a lot of development of organic nitrogen, and it's changing our nutrient story. So we're not so much trying to hit numbers anymore. It's a good thing to know what your YAM is, just to kind of be like, okay, well, that's really, it's 30. That's really low. But we don't do as much additive nutrition any longer, at least in our protocols, trying to achieve a number. It's more, because when you look at the nitrogen contribution of like an organic source, it looks negligible. It looks like such a small amount of nitrogen when you compare it to the same equivalent like weight of diammonium phosphate. But what we find, it's the same thing with whole grains versus straight sugar, right? DAP is essentially a diet of simple sugars, right? It's gonna rev the yeast up, it's gonna get it going, and then they're gonna crash and burn. Whereas something like an organic nitrogen, it actually steadies out the fermentation curve, and yeast assimilate it differently, and actually produce better aromatics. So, no, we're not trying to achieve necessarily 200 milligrams of nitrogen, but it is really good to know out the gate, hey, I have nothing in here. So what am I gonna do to help that? We have rehydration nutrients that we suggest that help kind of shore up the yeast and get it prepared for the environment. And then most of our strategies now involve a combination of one, either just straight organic nitrogen. I have several cideries that just use organic nitrogen product. And then others where they just know they have tricky varietals and they'll shore that up with one of our complex nutrients. It does contain a little bit of DAP, but it also contains organic nitrogen and vitamins and minerals. So it's kind of playing that game. And yes, if you see something that's a high nutrient demand, you're gonna have to boost that up. But trying to hit a number, and we don't have a good matrix anymore, because people still try and achieve these numbers. So we have like multipliers that we apply to organic nitrogen now to try and get it so people can hit their numbers. A lot of it's you kind of have to play, because we do find that the fermentations are much steadier, you have less heat spikes, and you have better finishes to your fermentation. The fermentation curve drops off faster with organic nutrition, and the aromatics are much more complex, because the way yeast makes flavors is by consuming amino acids and excreting byproducts of those amino acids. So when you have organic nitrogen, you have more complex aromatics that develop during that fermentation.
And sorry, and what it just on that, the time release nutrients, do you have a perspective on those versus?
We don't have one in our portfolio. The one thing, I don't really have it, because I don't know how really they work. We like timed additions just because you're hitting those kind of important growth points. Our particular regimen typically is, if you're highly deficient, is adding an organic nitrogen source before you inoculate. We don't like to add anything containing DAP to the juice because that actually promotes yeast growth, which you would think would be a good thing, but it also puts them on the pathway to only wanting DAP. And so we would do an organic nitrogen and then do another addition at least 1/3. But sometimes we do one at the end of lag phase and then at 1/3 sugar depletion. And so we like those targeted because you're hitting important milestones for when the yeast likes nutrition. With the time release, I don't know when those are being released. And so I can't really speak to those products.
Yes?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. When you say organic nitrogen, is that simply just nitrogenous amino acids or are there other things involved?
So it's generally yeast derived. So he's asking about organic nitrogen, what that is sourced from. And so the organic nitrogen or organic nutrients on the market are usually...
Holes?
They're not holes because holes have no nutrition. That's just the cell component. It's yeast. Our particular product is yeast that has been identified as having high bioavailable nutrition, and they're processed in a certain way to kind of maximize those nutrients. But it is yeast eating other yeast. So cannibalism is a thing. Okay. We use a lot of yeast derivatives in our stuff, and it's like, oh, you use this, and it's yeast eating other yeast. But they like it. It's good. It's how they, you know, replenish their amino acid content. And then other control points. So a lot of people think, okay, I have my yeast, I have my nutrition, I'm done. And then they're like, why is this still happening? And what people don't take into consideration is that there's a lot of other components that come into play. Now, oxygen is really important for a healthy fermentation. But I have there, okay, is oxygen friend or foe? Because for finished cider, we do not want oxygen, right? So that oxidizes the product, we get aldehydes, we get sherry character, not delicious. So a lot of people are afraid of introducing oxygen in their fermentations because they're worried that they're gonna oxidize their product. Now, if you have an active yeast fermentation going, yeast will consume that oxygen immediately. So what we suggest is introducing oxygen in the first third, maybe first half of fermentation. After that, it's not kind of taking it in the same way, but it doesn't matter if you're using, people will, the wine industry, they'll do like a rapid return. Splashing introduces very little oxygen, but it is stirring things up, which is beneficial. You can use a Venturi device to inject oxygen. That's what this guy is right here. You can use stones, inject oxygen that way. There's a bunch of different things that you can do, but again, if you're having lots of issues, you think you have your nutrition dialed in, you know you're not gonna change your yeast, things like that, try introducing some oxygen, that first third of fermentation, and you can really see some benefit. Again, don't go too crazy at the end, but really with any of these devices, you're not introducing enough oxygen that the yeast cannot handle because they will eat through it as quickly as they can. Buffering capacity is huge in mead. So if anybody makes any honey products, honey has no buffering capacity, which you can have super huge pH swings during your fermentation. And so when you start out with a honey at like 3.8 and it drops to 2.9 first 24 hours, that's really stressful on the yeast. Apples, it's not too problematic until you get to a really low pH. So most people using dessert apples don't run into this problem at all. But if you have any sort of cider apples, things like that have a much higher, much lower pH, if you're starting at a pH of like 3.1 or below for your juice, just know that first 24 to 48 hours, you can have a pretty dramatic pH change, and that can really whack your yeast pretty good. So certain things like that, if you know it's a low pH, I might suggest upping your inoculation a little bit, just because you know you're gonna get some die off right in that first 24 hours. Again, only if it's a really, really low pH to start with.
So in doing that, you're saying inoculate higher as opposed to, what do you say, buffering or having any additional ingredients?
Yeah, there's not really anything that's going to, I mean, in mead, I know some people will use like potassium carbonate to help with that buffering a little bit. I don't know that I would necessarily do, I mean, because we have people that do, you know, champagne, sparkling products, and they don't add anything to deacidulate to buffer, because there's usually enough kind of buffering capacity within that juice to handle it and not be too dramatic. So a little bit of a pH change is not the end of the world if you have some buffering capacity, but like meads have really nothing in them. So they need something to help kind of manage that pH thing. So that would be potassium carbonate, but again, that's going to adjust the pH. So just something to take into consideration.
Is that pH without degassing?
Yes. And then temperature. I already talked about this, but stay within the temperature parameters of your yeast. And then, so if you are using frozen juice, try not to inoculate at the low end of that yeast's temperature capacity. Because that's just, again, stressing the yeast to start with. And I know it's hard, right? Because you're thawing your juice and you're trying to get it to the right temperature, but you don't want something else to grow in it. So it's kind of playing that game. But if you inoculate at too cold of a temperature, the yeast is probably just going to freak out on you and start producing those sulfur compounds right from the beginning. So just take that in mind.
What are you thinking of as too cold of a temperature if you are following proper rehydration?
So the yeast have different temperature constraints. So just, I mean, I wouldn't inoculate really anything below 55. And then if you are, temperate the bejesus out of it. You know, so never put hot yeast in cold must. It's bad. You kill it pretty much right away. It's temperature shock. So you want to make sure that you, if you are going cold, again, realize you're going to stress the yeast, but you want to make sure you follow the rehydration protocol. It starts out like 104 degrees. Wait 20 minutes. Add a little bit of juice, slowly bring the temperature down, wait another 20 minutes, slowly bring the temperature down. If it's below 55, you want to be within 5 degrees Fahrenheit before you pitch that yeast. So do a lot of atemperations to get to that point. Yeah?
A lot of yeast have that 45-minute temperation mm-hmm. kind of guideline to not exceed 45 minutes. What's the danger?
So
if
you
kind of a little bit longer yeast buildup?
If you're adding juice to it every like 20 minutes, you can go longer than 45 minutes. You don't ever just want to let a yeast sit, though. So some people are like, well, it's hot, so I'm just gonna let it cool down. You know, if it's a small vessel, it cools down pretty quick and then you can just add it. But if you have like a larger vessel of rehydrated yeast, it takes a long time to actually get to the appropriate temperature, and there's no food source. So when there's no food source, the yeast is like, all right, I'm just gonna die. there's nothing going on here. So you just wanna make sure if you're adding the juice, in that kind of cadence, again, every 20 minutes, you're fine.
Is like several hours would be way too long, or you definitely need to get something longer?
I mean, you're gonna start getting, your biomass is gonna start to build, so it shouldn't take you several hours unless you're doing a giant pitch of yeast. And most, it shouldn't take that long. Even the large wineries, it shouldn't take that long, because you're basically adding equal portions of juice each time to what you started with. So really it should maybe take 4 steps to get it down to 10. And again, that's every 15, 20 minutes. So, and then don't let it sit. Like some people will think, oh, I'm gonna let it sit in this like propagation tank overnight. If you do that, it could blow through that sugar. And then when you go to actually inoculate the next day, it's dying. So try and get it into your must in a timely manner. And then keep yeast in suspension. It's a simple thing, and it's one of those things that in the wine industry, in particular, like reds, they're punching down, they're moving the cap, they're messing with it all the time, right? A lot of people with, especially the fear of oxygen, for white wine production or for cider production, they don't mess with it once it starts fermenting. And depending on the clarity of your juice starting out, and then the type of tank you have. So if you've been doing small batch production and you've been using small pick bins or the totes that are kind of squat square, and then you buy a big long tall tank, dairy tank, and all of a sudden you're like, I didn't change anything in my fermentation practices, but all of a sudden I'm just getting stinky product all the time. That's because you get that yeast stratification that I already talked about. And you wanna make sure you're just kind of keeping your yeast in suspension. First, third, you can kick that up however you want. You can pump oxygen through it. You can get the yeast in suspension that way. After that kind of one third, one half, I don't really necessarily recommend the oxidation or the adding oxygen. So just, I don't know, get in there with a paddle. Kick it up, try and get the yeast off the floor. Mix it with an inert gas. You can mix it with CO2. I don't particularly like to use CO2 for mixing just because it does go into solution and you already have a lot in solution from the fermentation, but you can. But just keep it kicked up. Yep.
What about pump overs?
Pump overs are fine. Try not to splash too much if it's after that one half, but that's totally fine. How often do you have to do that? 3 times a day? No. Is it beneficial to maybe do it once a day? Yeah, probably, especially if you're having persistent issues. So it's also a way to kind of keep your fermentations roaring along. If you want to keep them going at a steady clip and you have certain production demands in terms of speed that you want to get things finished, that's a way to keep things going. And it's simple, right? But it's funny because I've been to some of the large cider producers and their tanks don't actually allow them to do these kind of interventions. And they just don't have the time or work orders, things like that. So it's a simple thing that you feel like should be like, oh, just stir it. Like, I don't have to change my nutrient strategy. I don't have to change my yeast. First thing I can try is stirring my fermentation. And sometimes people can't do it. So I will say I have heard that excuse, but it's a good thing to start with before you have to change any of your, and you don't have to buy anything from me to stir it, right? You could buy a Venturi device, but see, it's not even like a sales pitch. Stir your fermentations. If we're talking about storage, if we're doing any sort of aging on the lees, again, just because the yeast is dead doesn't mean it's still producing sulfur off compounds. So definitely rack off your gross lees. Okay? If you're having any sort of fine lees that you want to age on to get that kind of leesy, creamy character, you can do that. But if you had any stink during your fermentation, do not use those lees. You can use lees from another fermentation that weren't stinky. We have products that are known to be replacement lees. You can use those that have their sulfur reductase pathway disabled, so they're not going to produce sulfur off notes. Just don't keep it on stinky product. And it's funny because I've had people who will call and they're like, yeah, I did bench trials. I tried to intervene with copper and like it's still stinky. I'm like, well, did you rack? And they're like, well, no, I was just doing bench trials on the small. I'm like, well, why don't you rack off the cider and see what happens? Because a lot of times yeast has amazing bioabsorptive properties. We have products, people are like, what do you use that for? I'm like, well, it's supposed to be for this, but we use it because it sucks up aroma and stuff like that. It is amazing. It holds a lot of aroma in it. And so sometimes it's as simple as just getting it off the stinky lees, and then all of a sudden the cider smells fine. So rack. So these are, again, simple things. Don't involve purchasing product. Stir your fermentations and then rack when they're done. And so carbon dioxide, right? Most people are doing carbonated ciders, can actually magnify the effect of sulfur compounds. So if you notice that when you go to can, or you go to bottle your product, all of a sudden something's rearing its head, and you're like, it smelled fine. That's part of it, is that kind of magnification that you get from CO2. Now, how are you gonna know that? You're not gonna know until it happens, but just something to take into consideration. And then final packaging. So looking at your packaging options, if you're bottling under cork has some oxygen ingress. If you're bottling under crown caps, those are not necessarily always oxygen tight. Different crown caps have different oxygen permeability. Something to look at. If you have something that has a very tight permeability, so little to no oxygen goes through, that can actually put the cider in a more reductive environment, meaning there's not a lot of oxygen. And so some of these sulfur compounds can be reduced into their more aromatic form, and they kind of appear after that. We see it a lot in the wine industry when somebody goes under screw cap, because screw caps tend to be more airtight than cork, so they might have been making that wine for years, never had any problems, they put it under screw cap, and all of a sudden they're getting sulfur off odors all the time. Canning actually has high oxygen pickup, so you can get a lot of oxidation at the point of canning, and so again, as it's sitting in the can over time, those things can start to evolve as the oxygen kind of dissipates. So just things to take in consideration. Kind of the final topic that I was going to go over was, okay, well, I did everything I could, but something still happened. Because it does happen. And like I said, if you're having persistent issues, definitely look at the kind of prevention tools. But if it's something that you just want off, there are tools that you can do to mitigate it. So treat as soon as possible. As soon as you start smelling stink, try and do something to intervene. As I mentioned, if it's during the fermentation, it's the first third, try and add more nutrients. If it's the last third, there's yeast products or yeast hull products, so the cell walls. Like I said, they don't really provide nutrition, but they have good bioabsorptive properties, and that's a way that you could potentially absorb some of those compounds as they're evolving. So if it's, you want to rack off those lees. If it's post-fermentation, don't wait during aging. Most cideries don't age like wine does, but it's amazing to me, wineries, they're like, yeah, I noticed it was a little stinky when I, you know, racked it into the barrel, and then they just left it for months, and they're like, well, it smells really bad now. I'm like, yeah, it can do that. And now you've got it into an oxidized form that's gonna be much harder to remove. So treat as soon as you can. One of the simplest things is the penny test. I don't know, you've seen wine sommeliers that throw a penny in there. Make sure it's a penny, ideally before 1982. Kind of hard to come by these days, but pennies don't contain that much copper anymore. So the whole thing is that you want something containing copper. You guys have seen Shay. He has a thing that he wears around his neck. It's like a little copper medallion. He whips that out and throws it in beverage all the time. So it's a good way, a quick, easy test to figure out what your copper compound is. The penny test will identify whether it's H2S or mercaptan. If those don't fix it, you're going to have to go with other options. And honestly, for that, I would call. But if the penny test doesn't work, again, if you try and aerate and it blows off, that can identify H2S, but it could also be oxidizing it and moving it to a non-aromatic form. That can be more problematic. Question?
How long should the penny test take to react?
It should be pretty much instantaneous.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you swirl it for a minute, pour off the product, and it should be pretty much instantaneous.
We're from Canada, and we don't have pennies anymore. Are there any?
You can look for any sort. I mean, so in some wineries, they'll use copper fittings or copper pipes to just kind of do their pump overs and stuff like that. Copper's not the easiest thing to clean. It's not the best for sanitation, things like that. But you can't, it's copper.
Okay.
You just need something that contains copper.
All right.
We also have products that actually contain, you could do a copper sulfate test, or we have products that contain copper that you can also test with that. But I mean, I have access to our products, so I just test with the products that we have and see if that works. But something containing copper. And I've heard of people, they're like, yeah, we just take a bunch of old copper fittings and like put in a mesh bag and drop it in our tank. I'm all, okay. Not the best, but yes.
I notice you don't put it on, so I imagine you don't stir in with the copper rod during fermentation, so you're not introducing too much oxygen. You don't particularly.
It will definitely absorb some of the copper compounds that are evolving. How much though, because there's not a ton of surface area on that, is hard to say, but it'll definitely absorb some. Yeah. Copper's expensive. So, I mean, most people, you know, if you have a copper rod to stir with, sure, go for it. But it's pretty expensive, so. And then,
question?
Uh-huh.
So are you using the copper to determine the presence of the sulfur compound? Or are you also using it to remove the sulfur?
So as a quick test, before you want to get into actually doing full-fledged bench trials, I like ease of use, because bench trials are a bear, and especially if you don't think it's gonna work, or you're not sure if it's gonna work, that's more of identifying, like, hey, if I treat this with something containing copper, it's gonna help my issue. Then you say, okay, well, I'm gonna do bench trials with this product, and this product, and you can kind of target. And then what I suggest to you, if you're doing bench trials with multiple products, is do your first bench trial where you have a control, and say you have three products that you're testing. Do the mid-range dosage for those three products. Let them do their thing, rack, pour off the wine or whatever, and then see the results. And then you can say, okay, well, I like what this one did. Now I'm actually gonna do a real bench trial with this product with measured doses to figure out how much I actually need to take care of the issue. Because one of the things that we see happen is people will call and they're like, they have finding issues or having something. They're like, send me all the samples you have. I'm like, really, you want 15 finding agents? Because you're not gonna do bench trials with 15 finding agents. You're just not. It's overwhelming, right? Like, how do you even start? What do you even begin with? So we really try and dial in when we're talking to our clients which products they should play with. And then from there, we have them really dial it in and do the bench trials. In terms of actually doing your bench trials, you can do a trial with copper sulfate. You can also try just yeast derivatives, just straight yeast derivatives. We have one in our portfolio that is meant to be a lees replacement, that you're supposed to let it sit on the lees for like 6 months for it to do a thing. We honestly add it back after 24 hours for stinky compounds all the time, but it works great. And then we also have one that has actually contains copper as well. And I like to look at the degree of your issue and kind of play with it from there. If you can get away with just treating it with a yeast product, it's much more palatable and much more easy on the sensory. Anything that contains copper is going to have some sort of stripping effect on the palate, and it can make the cider feel really kind of rough and abrasive. And so you've reduced, obviously, you removed the smell, but then you've also made something that maybe is not as appealing on the palate. So that's kind of my last ditch effort, is straight copper sulfate. Things to take in consideration is that there is a legal limit and safe consumption level for copper. So just don't go hog wild with adding copper sulfate, because that is dangerous to you. Don't taste those products, okay? You don't want to taste anything that you've just added copper sulfate to. You want to rack and make sure it's within the appropriate range. And again, you can't sell that to a consumer if it was above the legal limit. So just dial that in. So like I said, that's one of the reasons why we also like to start with yeast derivatives or something like that, because you're more metered in what you're applying. And then if the penny test doesn't do anything, you're likely in a disulfide form, and you have to treat with like ascorbic acid to reduce that to a like mercaptan to then remove it. And that's kind of hit or miss for when it works and when it doesn't.
Thank you to Rebecca DeKramer of Scott Laboratory and the United States Association of Cider Makers for allowing me to both record and post this week's episode. Very informative. If you still haven't downloaded the PDF file of the PowerPoint presented during this workshop, please do by going to ciderchat.com, episode 119. You'll see the link there. And while you're on the website, don't forget to contact me, Rhea@ciderchat.com, for the Totally Cider Tour to Normandy in September 2018. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I'm looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!